Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast. We are at Proper 11 in Year A, our worship series, What Makes Christians Different? I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. With me for the series are two preachers, Pastor Nathan Nass from Christ the King in Tulsa, Oklahoma, excuse me, and Pastor Pete Zafras from Pilgrim Lutheran in Mesa, Arizona. Pete and Nathan, good to be with you again. Nathan, could we start with you? Just remind preachers, what is the theme for this Sunday in our worship series?
Our theme for the series again is what makes Christians different. And this week, the special focus is that Christians live as wheat among the weeds. That comes out especially in the gospel lessons, which has a parable from Jesus. But the idea is something I think we can understand really well, that in this world we see believers and unbelievers seemingly mixed together, just like wheat and weeds. And this can cause us concern as pastors and even as individual Christians. What should be done about the weeds and the wheat being mixed together? And the focus today is to remind us that Christians live as wheat among weeds.
Thank you. And the other readings for the day before we get into Isaiah chapter 44, Pete.
Yeah, so we're in the middle of a 3-week stint in Matthew chapter 13, focusing on a number of parables through which Jesus teaches us about the kingdom of heaven as we see it in this life. And last week we focused on the reality that the kingdom of heaven is given to us through the gospel and word and sacrament. And as God brings his kingdom to us through his word is always working. Now that we know that God works through the means of grace, this week we're reminded God doesn't always work the way that you and I would expect him to, or maybe even think he should. And then next week we're going to marvel at the value that's provided to us by God through the gospel. But this week's focus is really going to be on the fact that God doesn't always do things the way that we might expect him to. So in that the parable of the wheat and the weeds, it's a pretty simple framework. You have a man who sows good wheat seeds into his field. At night, while everyone's sleeping, his enemy comes and sows weeds among the wheat. And then a third party, the landowner's servants, they want to know if maybe these weeds should be removed, if they should go out and pull the weeds. And the farmer says, no, let's not do that. We might pull up the good wheat. Let's let it stay. And it might be helpful to just make sure that we're aware that our listeners, as they hear this parable, they might identify with the servants who are asking these questions, who are, hey, you want us to go pull the weeds? It might be helpful to just point out, maybe in a reading introduction, we're the you're either the wheat or the weeds. This conversation happening between the servants, this has nothing to do with us. And then in the we get the explanation from Jesus in the second half of the text. He makes it very clear. He is the sower of the good seed. The field is the world, the children of the kingdom of heaven, that's the good seed, the wheat. The weeds, that's the children of the evil one. And of course, the enemy is the devil himself. The harvesters are the angels, and the separation of the wheat and the weeds is the judgment that's coming. God wants us to be patient. So what makes Christians different? Because we have an eye on the future, because we hold the promises of God, including the promise of the coming judgment, we live as wheat among the weeds. And so the other readings then play in this sandbox that Jesus has essentially built for us, this parable, this scene of a field with wheat and weeds. The other readings are going to help us see how it's possible for Christians to patiently live as wheat surrounded by the weeds. We'll get to the Isaiah text in a little bit, but the reading from Romans chapter 1, we get this very clear explanation that our God, he continually demonstrates how perfect his justice is. He will never allow for his people to be uprooted and accidentally thrown in with the weeds. That's not going to happen. There's going to be a large focus on the first commandment this week. And this text from Romans 1 makes it crystal clear that it is the height of foolishness to rely on any created thing as a God in place of the Creator himself. This is the definition of to exchange the truth of God for a lie. So it's really important to just remember as we look at these other readings, it's not that God is leaving the weeds unaddressed. It's not that he completely ignores the concerns of these servants who think, hey, this is a problem, we got to get rid of these weeds. Actually, while we're here in the kingdom of heaven on earth, our God is making sure that there is absolutely no excuse for those who are bundled and burned at the judgment. And that comes out really clearly in this text from Romans 1.
Yeah, thank you for that and providing our listeners with kind of a connecting points, a connecting tissue between the readings today. Well, let's get into the recommended sermon text then, Isaiah chapter 44, verses 6 through 11. Nathan, could you get our preachers thinking about some things perhaps they uncovered in their studies, but things you find especially noteworthy?
Yes, first I have to admit I've never preached on this text before. And if I was looking correctly, I think it might be new into the lectionary itself, that this has not always been in the 3-year lectionary. And so maybe for many of you preachers, you get to preach on this for the first time. And to me, there's always joy in studying a section of scripture I've never preached on before. Of course, when we're in Isaiah, it's always good to look around at the context. Isaiah 44 is in the second half of Isaiah in the book of comfort. After the book of judgment, the first 39 chapters. It's interesting, even in that second part of Isaiah, how chapter after chapter expresses two truths, comfort from God, and at the same time, still rebuke of God's people's sins. And so the two chapters before 44, 42 starts with talking about the servant of the Lord, just beautiful gospel, but then followed by Israel as blind and deaf. Chapter 43 starts with Israel's only savior, beautiful gospel, followed by Israel's unfaithfulness in the end of the chapter. So we have this over and over again, God's grace and unfailing love at the same time, coupled with the people's unfaithfulness and idolatry. And we see both of those things very clearly in our short 6-verse lesson. One other note on our lesson, it's that this lesson really is maybe the opposite of how we're used to preaching a sermon, in that the gospel parts all come first, and the law parts all come second. And so, this is something for a preacher to think about. The first verses are the beautiful gospel, the second three verses are the law. Maybe it's a time in your sermon to switch around whatever usual format you have and to let the text determine a different format and outline than what you usually follow. I want to focus on verse 6. Because it's just a beautiful verse packed full with about as much information about God as you could possibly find in any verse. I thought I would just go through it just as one verse using the Hebrew, because we should hear Hebrew every once in a while. So it says, Ko amar Adonai, thus says the Lord. And then we get a list of titles for God. Melech Yisrael, Vegoalo, Adonai Tzabaot, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. Just one thing after another piled up talking about God. And finally, God speaks, Ani Rishon v'ani Acharon. I first and I last. Hu Mibaladai. Ain Elohim, and besides me, there is not a God. And again, I would encourage you preachers, just spend time in this one verse thinking about what it says about God, focusing especially on the titles. First, we've got the Lord. I won't focus on that. We know about Adonai, the Tetragrammaton. But then we have Melech Israel, the King of Israel. And at a period of time when there was unrest in Isaiah's day. There's one true king, and it's the Lord. He's the King of Israel. Of course, in our day today, there's a lot of talk about kings and who is kings and whether we want a king. And for the preacher to say there is one king over God's people, that king, though, is also His Redeemer, his Goel. This is the word that we especially learn from the book of Ruth about Boaz being this kinsman redeemer for Ruth. And of course, God is our great redeemer. The word Goel, or some form of it, appears over a dozen times in Isaiah. And so just do a search in Isaiah of the word redeem and see all the passages that come up. I especially noted that a number of those passages talk about sin. Isaiah 44:22, I have swept away your offenses like a cloud, your sins like the morning mist. Return to me, for I have redeemed you. And just this beautiful picture, all the sins of God's people. God has bought back his people, redeemed them, and he's the Lord of hosts. And so he's the one controlling all the armies in heaven and on earth. And as a preacher, you could make a lot of headway with those terms. And then God starts talking, I'm the first and I'm the last. Of course, that appears other places in Isaiah and in the Bible all the way up to the end. It's like saying, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, no one like our God. And besides me, there is not a God. And so the monotheism of Israel was something that was absolute and should be for us today. There is no one like our God. So that's a lot just on one verse, but I think for this text, here's all the gospel and really the meat of the text right in this. Look at who our God is, and that's our starting point.
Yeah, bringing out the qualities in each one of those pictures, titles. Yeah, just grace abounding right in those titles that you unpacked for us, Nathan. Pete, your reflections on the text, either that verse or going on from there?
Yeah, I'm gonna Nate set us up really well on verse 6. I'm gonna just have a couple comments on verses 7 and 8 before we get to those clear law thoughts in the second half of the text. We're gonna, I think, as preachers, gonna have to do some work to tie these readings together for our people. And the Romans reading, as we just talked about it a minute ago, it really does set up a nice balance between the natural knowledge of God and the revealed knowledge of God. And so everyone has this natural knowledge of God. They have a natural understanding of who God is just by observing the creation of the world. But of course, there are things we don't know about God in nature. And we have so much of the things that are revealed about him in these first three verses. Everything that Nathan just brought out in verse 6 connected to these names of God. But then again, in verses 7 and 8, we have so much more summarized that has been revealed to us already in the scriptures about who God is and what he's like. He has a track record. He is a God who prophesies about future things. And he doesn't just talk, he does what he says. And boy, you could have some fun with that. Just going through a very simple Old Testament summary, you could give some examples of God saying in the book of Exodus, I'm going to send this one specific plague, and then doing exactly what he said he was going to do, not once, but 10 times. And there's all these examples of God making these predictions of the future. And he's, who's like me? Who can do this? Who can announce the future? If anyone else can do it, let him try. Let him make a prediction and then bring it to fulfillment. I've made this covenant with these people of Olam. There's an interesting commentary in Pieper here. Some have tried to say that this is some sort of picture of God's people enduring into, there's this eternal aspect of God's people. But Pieper makes a really clear point that based on the context here, this is God talking about how he has established humanity. He's the one who has created mankind. He is the one who has interacted with mankind from the very beginning, and he has been right there the whole way. And of course, that opens the door for Genesis 3 preaching, where he's right there to preach gospel immediately after his people have fallen. Again, he has a track record of making promises that he then carries through as the prophecies about who the Messiah would be are fleshed out throughout the Old Testament. And then verse 8, just a wonderful word of encouragement. Because of who God is, because of what God has said, because of what God has declared, because of what we have witnessed, we have no reason to be to be terrified. We have no reason to be afraid. We have no reason to be stunned. We have no reason to be shaken when we see things around us. And one of the things we're going to be focusing on is this picture of weeds being among the wheat. Why is there so much of this evil around me? Why is God allowing it? These things might startle us or drive fear into our hearts, but God says, my track record, who I am and what I'm like and what I've done, what I've revealed to you about myself beyond what's revealed in creation, is enough that you would not have any reason to fear. There is no God but me. You are witnesses of this. There's no rock other than me. I'm the only one.
Right. Therefore, do not tremble, do not be afraid, right? No matter what you see around you. Nathan, would you like to talk a little bit about verses 9 to 11? That this, yeah, as you mentioned before, that warning section at the conclusion of the text.
So this text certainly has a very clear division in it. Three verses talking about God, and then three verses getting into the foolishness of idols. First, as a preacher, you should certainly read the rest of the chapter. So, like often that our text is just cutting out of a larger section, this criticism of idols goes all the way through to the end of the chapter, and really some of the harshest words are not found in our text. Isaiah gives a what historians call a very accurate picture of how you would create an idol, from cutting down a tree to actually dedicating that idol. And throughout the whole process, Isaiah mocks it. Just before actually looking at the verses, one thing that was helpful for me to think through was we don't think about idols today, at least not very much. And if we do, we think that they're stupid, right? So it's kind of like, who would do this? Of course, if Isaiah's going to write these words down, this would have been incredibly countercultural for him to write. He's de-deifying the idols of the ancient world. And for Isaiah to speak so strongly against, like this was really putting his life in danger. This was saying something that almost nobody else was saying. And what he says, of course, from God, is starting with verse 9, all who make idols are nothing, and the things they treasure are worthless. In fact, these idols are going to lead to people's shame. And so Isaiah doesn't hold back at all. He doesn't say, you know, having some other gods in your life, it's kind of helpful, you know, cover all your bases. He says they're absolutely nothing. In verse 10, who shapes a god and casts an idol which can profit nothing. There's absolutely nothing to be gained to worshiping something other than the Lord, our rock and our Redeemer. Verse 11, how it ends, let them all come together, they will be brought down to terror and shame. And maybe the theme of Isaiah's words is, how can a creature make a creator? How can just a creature on earth form something that actually creates? And of course, this is ludicrous. The idea that we human beings could create a God who then would be over us as human beings, this is idolatry. It doesn't make sense. And guys, especially like if you read on ahead to verse 15, he talks about using the same wood for two purposes. So it is used as fuel for burning. Some of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. But he also fashions a god and worships it. He makes an idol and bows down to it. We're going to use the same wood, burn half of it, and then make an idol of the other half and worship it and bow. This is just the lunacy of idolatry. And yet, clearly, this is what God's own people were tempted to fall into. And so we hear Isaiah's call, why are you doing this? Why trade God for nothing?
Right, and maybe that's a good segue into thinking about the law in the text or the malady of the text as we share this with our listeners and help them wrestle with sinful tendencies and temptations. Pete, some thoughts on that or expanding on what Nathan was saying?
Something that I'm concerned about as a preacher here is that my people would hear the mockery of idols and say, yeah, that is really stupid. I'm sure glad I don't do that. I've never bowed down to a hunk of wood. I've never viewed these things in such a way. Sure, glad I'm not an idolater. And there's a really awesome quote that I use all the time when teaching the First Commandment in Luther's Large Catechism that I think is helpful here. He's essentially saying if you're going to teach a little kid that they shouldn't have other gods, you do well to make sure they know what other gods are. And he says, here's how I teach it. A god means that from which we are to expect all good and in which we are to take refuge in all distress. So any source of blessing, any source of comfort becomes a god for us. And then you play with that a little bit and you start to realize why it is that we're so good at making idols. As a little child, the minute that child forgets that it is actually God who is providing them with blessings and providing them with comfort through their mother and father, mom and dad have become the source of the blessing, the source of the comfort. And just like that, mom and dad have become a god. But when the child knows and believes it's actually God who is blessing me through my mother and father, what a wonderful gift from God to me that he would work this way. Well, now mom and dad are not gods for you. Well, and you can do this with anything. You can do this with a vacation that you're looking forward to. The moment the vacation is the source of blessing, the source of comfort, it is a god for you. But when it is your God who is blessing you through that vacation, it is not a god for you. And you can go on and on. Alcohol is so easily a god for people. Why? Because it becomes the source of comfort, the source of blessing. We are capable of rejoicing with the psalm writer in Psalm 104 and praising God for wine that gladdens the heart of man. But oh, how easy it is to not do that. Oh, how easy it is to actually go to the thing, to the substance, to the place, to the person, to allow that to become the source itself and not the conduit through which God gives blessing. Just to bring out how easily it is for us to take any blessing, anything in all of creation, and turn it into a god, and then go mock it again. I think that's how you hit people. That's how you make this precision cut to the heart to reveal the idolatry that is in all of us. Maybe mock the caricature of idolatry, the Old Testament idolatry. Maybe let them begin to fall into that trap a little bit. And then teach them to see the idols in their own lives and then come back to the mockery approach again. How foolish to think that any of these created things could do what God does. There's some really sharp law in this text.
Right, Nathan?
Yeah, I appreciate, Pete, your emphasis on making sure we're applying it to our people's hearts, not just to the foolishness of the past or the foolishness out there. I thought to myself, what are examples of us, like that man cutting down a tree and making an idol? What do we do? And some examples I thought of is we invent a sport. We put a peach basket up on a wall and throw a ball at it. And we invented the sport, we make the rules for it, and then we glorify it, and then we praise those who are good at that sport and treat them as if winning in this sport is what's all that matters. And you just look at we did the whole process. And maybe you take a $20 bill and it's a piece of paper. Some paper we use as kindling to start a campfire, and some paper, the very same paper, we treat as though it's the most important thing. We decided to use paper, put this printing on it, and then all of a sudden it's worth all this money, and we live our lives for it. And or maybe we create a missile and we shoot it at another country, and then we feel like we're powerful. And it's just all we have created this, and then we worship it as if it's our God. And maybe the main point of the text would be, why would you want to trade the true God for that? Why, if you know the true Lord Redeemer, Rock, why would we trade him for all these false idols that we make? It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah, all these things, good creations of God, things that can be used in joy and freedom and to God's glory, even. But right, when we invest in them all this meaning that should be attached to God alone, the creator, right? That's when things just go off the rails. Pete, further thoughts?
Yeah, the approach here, it seems to be that the Israelites were afraid of these other gods too. That they're that part of the I think part of the approach in mocking them is to remove any fear that the people have of these gods. So there's the, like don't trust in these gods is certainly one of the points, but also you have no, why would you fear these things? Why would you be afraid? And I think that's where we could tie it in to this idea of the parable and the wheat and the weeds. Why are we so shaken, to use some of the pictures in the text? Why are we so afraid? Why are we so stunned by the fact that there are weeds all around us? Why are we so surprised that there are people who believe in other gods, who reject the King of Israel, the Redeemer of Israel? Why are we so afraid of this? Our God has a plan. He's revealed the plan to us. He is working this plan out. The word has been preached to you, to me. We are the wheat in the field. We're going to get to this as we begin to preach the gospel. But we have nothing to fear. There's nothing to be afraid of here as we look around us and see this challenging situation, wheat surrounded by weeds. Don't be afraid of what you see around you. Don't be afraid of the devil's seed.
Great. Then pivoting to the gospel thoughts that are here, and Nathan, you described very well the names of God in verse 6, filled with gospel, each one of them. But how might you suggest preachers proclaim the gospel in light of the law that we've just highlighted?
The different words in verse 6, you could choose any of the pictures there. For me, one that really stands out is just the word redeemer. And like I said a few minutes ago, if you look that word up in Isaiah, it often is connected with sins. And so God is our redeemer. And when you really think about the foolishness of idolatry in our own lives, it does lead to shame, just like verse 9 says. But to know we have a redeemer who bought me back from that I've already been purchased back from my foolish thoughts, from my foolish beliefs, from my foolish fears. There's a redeemer, and it's my God. And that word redeemer, I think, is one way that you can always make a connection to the cross. And when I do that, I always think about Luther's explanation to the second article, that he has redeemed me, a lost and condemned creature, purchased and won me from all sin, death, and the power of the devil, not with gold or silver, but with his holy precious blood and with his innocent suffering and death. And yeah, we have done some really foolish things. We have gone after idols that we have made. And God, he came after us and he gave his own life for us. And why again, why would we want to trade that for anything? Right? When you see the love of Jesus, there's nothing else that can love you like Jesus does.
Excellent. Further gospel thoughts, Pete?
Definitely encourage the brothers to make sure you read the verses leading into the text and read through the end of the chapter. There's gospel surrounding this entire section. Not only do the first three verses of our text are they full of gospel, the beginning of the chapter is just full of gospel. There's some beautiful baptism pictures in those first verses. The name God is calling us his own. He is pouring out his spirit on us, water on thirsty land, streams on the dry ground. Just some beautiful connections to the promises of God made to his people in baptismal waters. And then, yeah, just to again to dive into everything that has been revealed about our God, who rescues the greatest of fools. Like after we've used that sharp law to reveal how foolish we are, just to continually come back. And I think this would be one of those instances where certainly don't neglect the gospel pictures in verses 6, 7, and 8. Bring them all out. But because the law is so sharp, I would encourage bring in all the pictures from verses 1 to 5. Maybe you go to verses 21 to 23 at the end. Nate already referenced one of those. Bring in those expanded pictures on the redemption, sweeping away our offenses like a cloud, our sins like the morning mist. They're gone. We have been redeemed. It's a done deal. Bring those pictures out. Don't be afraid to use the whole chapter to really let the gospel predominate.
Yeah, great advice. Further thoughts on kind of takeaways for people. I know we of course mentioned some in terms of law and gospel and the names in the text, the warnings there, but anything else you would put in the category maybe of appropriation or application, things we really want to set into the hearts and lives of our listeners. Nathan, anything further?
One thing I noticed reading this text in this chapter is the idea that idolatry saps all your energy. To worship false gods really tires you out. And Isaiah paints this with, you got to cut down a tree, you got to fashion this idol, you got to make a fire, you got to dedicate it, cover it with. It is a whole lot of work to worship a false god. But the true God, what he does is he constantly fills you. And so when you look at your life, if you're always feeling empty, it's probably a sign that you and I are running after the wrong things. Having false gods is exhausting. But to believe in the one true Lord, to believe in Jesus, he's the living water, right? And the bread from heaven, and right, the true God is always filling you. The idol you're chasing is always taking from you.
Yeah, great thoughts. Pete, any further thoughts on appropriation application?
I want to resist the urge to not say the obvious thing. I think a great appropriation point here is just to make it clear, you are the wheat. You are the seed, the good seed that our God has sown. You are the ones who have been shown the foolishness of idolatry and who have been brought to faith in who God reveals himself to be, in the truth, and you believe what God actually reveals about himself and what he's done for you. You are the wheat. And kind of along the same lines, nothing is the purpose of this parable is really not to talk about all these things that the wheat needs to go do. The wheat just remains. It grows. We focused on that last week, how the seed, everything needed for the growth is in the seed. The power is in the word. God is doing all this work, and we just get to grow. We get to just be there, nourished by the means of grace, and wait for the harvest when perfect justice will be rendered, and there will be no more weeds all around us. God will do what is right, and those who are judged will be without excuse. I guess said very simply, you are wheat, believe it, right?
Yeah, a couple thoughts just on verse 8. Also, you are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? And that comes right after, do not tremble, do not be afraid. Yeah, maybe a point worth considering is rather than fretting about the weeds that surround us, being frustrated with God, perhaps that he's not dealing with them more decisively or sooner. Maybe there's a place to encourage, as you just said, Pete, first of all, remember you're the wheat and just revel in that grace that God shows us by making us his own planting, his own people. But maybe also it's witnessing to the weeds around us. That's something constructive we can be doing rather than just telling God he should be dealing with them. So, yeah. Maybe a thought that preachers could ponder there too. You are my witnesses while the weeds remain. Kind of bringing things together. Any ideas for preachers, whether that's a theme idea or a central thought or something to help organize the sermon? Nathan, possibilities?
Yeah, I've got three theme possibilities. First would be just the word incomparable. And so the text is really, it's comparing God with idols, and the result, it's really incomparable. We have the creator, versus creation. We have the one who gives and saves versus idols that you need you to give and save. So incomparable. The second possible theme would be you could say something like no other rock. Focusing on there's no rock beside our God. You can try to build your life on any other thing, but it won't hold you. No other rock. And then finally, maybe if you have that parable of the weeds and wheat in mind, and you think about the concerns we have, what about all the weeds? You could have a theme like God's got this. Like, look at who God is, look at who idols are. God's got this. You don't have to worry.
Yeah, thank you for those ideas. A lot for preachers to work with there. Pete, any ideas for themes or central thoughts that could unify a message?
I'm gonna try to stay in the parable as much as possible. I think it can be done. I think it's possible to preach this text in the context of the Sunday. And I'm gonna try to do that. I'm gonna try to stay within the context of the wheat and the weeds, and I'm gonna be very, very aware. As I was preparing for this, I caught myself saying weeds instead of wheat, saying wheat instead of weeds. For whatever reason, these words are kind of similar in my mind, and I think just maybe an encouragement to we don't want to mix those up. That'd be quite confusing for people in the sermon. So a little extra preparation to polish that up will probably be helpful, at least for me anyway. But yeah, just to focus on the essence here of who God is. I think I do think that in my heart anyway, relates to the questions that are asked in the parable, like, well, let's get rid of these weeds. They're a problem. We should get rid of these things. God's got this. I like that theme that Nathan has. I might steal that one. God's got this. Everything's going to be okay. His perfect justice, his perfect love, they're seen here in these texts. And you don't have to worry about making things right. You don't have to worry about that at all. God has done that. He has made me right. He has made you right. So I think it's going to be similar to what Nathan was getting at with the God's got this. Stop worrying about the weeds. That's not your role to worry about getting rid of these problem things. You just be the wheat. And yeah, that does include seed connected to our picture last week, which would be the spreading of the gospel. Yeah, God's got this.
Yeah, comforting thoughts as we live as wheat among the weeds. A lot of gospel comfort here in these verses from Isaiah, as you have both very well noted. Any further thoughts that we haven't had time to touch on yet? If not, then let's close and turn things over to preachers. The Lord bless you, preachers, as you proclaim the word of the Lord. There is no other God and no other Redeemer, but He is ours, and that is our comfort in this world.